Session number 17117, Reel 10.
Mr. Coco, Reel 10. Yeah.
The captain did give leave, and it was to Yarmouth itself, and leave expired at 6 o'clock. So you went ashore at noon and had to be back aboard at 6. But of course the object, of course, being as we were, was to go ashore to find a pub. But unfortunately, when we got to Yarmouth, no beer was to be had. And there were four of us at that time. We walked off then to Freshwater, and we found a pub, and we did manage to get a pint or two in and come back. And so it's a matter of here, we were down there waiting, whiling our time in that week. We were opposite Bewley, and we could see the number of American aircraft taking off, these Thunderbolt aircraft, the fighters, taking off regularly and landing again. And it was quite clear that things were brewing up, and you didn't need a great intelligence to know what it was. We did have hands to bathe and tried that. We had a very good swimmer aboard, a New Zealand lad whose name I forget, but I can remember he was always used to test, and I can remember him diving off the bridge, sponson, the side of the bridge, in a beautiful dive, and he came up somewhere near the stern. The current was that strong, and I remember the motorboat owned the dog we had called Monty dived off the forecastle and followed him, and both the dog and the seaman had to be rescued by the motorboat with the tide, so that we didn't swim too much in the Solent there. One thing we did do, and we did this on two successive days, we left the anchorage and went out through the Culshot Spit, and we came around in company with, and I can't remember again who that was, but we then came into Bournemouth Bay, and I can remember going at what was quite something, you know, quite what might I say, spectacular speed, and firing broadsides at the sands at Studland. And of course this was our practice run, and we then knew that obviously this is going to be the start of D-Day. But on D-Day itself, we were one of the first on the night. I can remember that motorboat going up and passing us, and the chappie waving his arms and shouting through a megaphone about postpone 24 hours. I can remember that as plainly as anything, because he was between us and Lymington. But anyway, when time came to slip, off we went, and there was a great feeling of excitement on this, because there was obviously a great big armada behind us. And I can remember going out through Culshot and looking back at the fading in the twilight, the cliffs of the Isle of Wight. And, you know, there was that feeling that this great big adventure is taking place now at long last, because much had been mooted about it in the past. And here we were, right out into the front of this thing. And of course, so it went on through the night. But as we came then to dawn and we approached the French coast, things got rather strangely quiet, as it were, on the bridge. And it's something odd, this, because on a destroyer in wartime, you've got always the perpetual, that's on the bridge of a destroyer in wartime, you've got all this perpetual bing, pinging on all the whole time, the Aztec thing, and this is going on the whole time. And of course there's all the usual chatter of port tens and, you know, steady and all this sort of thing, and orders going. But when it comes to actually making a landing, you know, the first signs of dawn are starting to appear, and you're approaching an enemy coast, and you get a dark outline of the enemy coast. And voices somehow seem to drop on the bridge. Voices tend to take on almost like a whisper Don't speak too loudly, otherwise they might hear us coming, this sort of thing. But anyway, on this particular morning, we found ourselves way out in front, and we approached the French coast, and the only ones in front of us was a motor minesweeper, like a little motorboat affair, and that was the nearest thing between us and the French coast on that morning of June the 6th at Arromanches. And we approached the coast, and as we approached the coast, as I say, tiptoeing in almost and speaking in quite low tones, and of course obviously we're all closed up at action stations then, and as it began got light, so of course they saw us, they opened fire on us on the from the cliffs on the to the east of Arromanches. And I thought, oh dear, having been at, you know, one or two other places on the North African coast, I thought, oh well, this is one where they are going to retaliate. And the only one injured, in fact, wounded on the ship, was in fact one of our was our messman in mess, a laddie called Victor Singer, and he had a piece of shrapnel in his ankle, and that was the only shell that really came near us. But anyway, they opened fire on us, and of course all the shells started to come over and the spouts went up in the water. But as this was happening, I can remember being in my position back of the bridge. The cruisers, there were four cruisers and four older cruisers at that, and I think the Enterprise was one of them, and I can hear as clearly as anything across the still water at that time, and of course being bigger ships, they go in for bugles and this sort of thing, the bugles about the action station and closing up, which surprised me. I thought they would have been already closed up, but anyway they swung into position where we were approaching Arromanches at right angles, as it were, in line ahead. They were abreast, the four cruisers of the coast, and they opened fire, and I've not known such efficient gunnery at all in my born day, because up till then, because I suppose that the place had been well researched. They knew precisely the position to be in. They had taken fixes from landward. They knew the exact position, and in a matter of minutes the batteries were knocked out one after the other, and we were quite safe. And we steamed on in and opened up on our pillbox, and I like to think we knocked that out quite quickly. We had an army major aboard who was known as the FOB, Forward Observation, and he was an artilleryman. And our second target was a mortar battery behind the church, but that one we never attempted to fire because we couldn't see it, and we had no clue where that was, because no sooner we'd opened fire on our target on the beach, the pillbox, and knocked that out, then almost simultaneously or shortly after that came in a wave of rocket firing typhoons and bombers, and the whole beach seemed to erupt and was covered in sand and smoke and everything. And in next to no time, where we had been right out into the front, to the forefront of the attack, we then were seeing soldiers going by us in these landing craft, and of course that was it. Our role had seemed to be over, and the whole thing was so totally well organized, because wheeling overhead the whole time were groups of four of Spitfires and Hurricanes and perfect air cover. And from then on we took on the role of rather observers rather than actual participants in the battle and in the fight. One of my memories of this is just leaning over the side of the bridge and looking at Arromanches itself, and as one looks to the westward side of the town, the road goes up quite a steepish hill and comes out clear of the houses and then turns inland into the countryside. And I can remember tanks coming up, and this would be now about 10:30, be about 11 o'clock in the morning. And coming out, the tanks would come out from the cover of the houses, and they poked their nose out into the open country road and about to turn inward. And of course they were hit and brewed up. Brewed up mean they just exploded. And that was something to us which, well, we had a great deal of sympathy with that. And I think there must have been about 5 or 6 tanks in succession came out of there, and they all brewed up one after the other. They were hit. And of course this then motivated us to some action, and there was an 88 that seemed up in the wood, and we had then an open fire at this thing up in the wood. And of course the German then stopped. He just retreated somewhere, and the tanks then came out and carried on. The place then assumed one of, well, much traffic, mostly going towards the beach. Out from the beach there started to gather by the afternoon flotsam of ration cardboard boxes and all this sort of thing coming out. And by this time, of course, one must bear in mind that we were quite close in. Indeed, we got so close in that we took our ASDIC dome, we scraped our ASDIC dome off the bottom of the ship on the sand underneath. And indeed, one of our group, the Stord, S-T-O-R-D, which was a Norwegian destroyer of a similar type to ourselves, hit a mine and sank. That was to the eastward of us, but since we were in such shallow waters, she sank with all her upper works visible. She was quite clearly seen. And so we spent the day. We did have a bit of a scare, in so much as we made our way eastwards, and that's going towards Le Havre. And I can recollect then there was some shelling then from shoreward, and this was another gun up in the wood on the enemy side of the Orne. And I can remember we closed up fully at action stations on this and returned the fire, and he packed up firing, and then we packed up firing, and we just resumed our stooging around. That night we just went up and down, as I recollect, the beachhead with just the screw barely turning. And I can remember that well, down in the mess we were all blacked out down there, and we were sitting down there having a smoke, and you would hear like scraping sides on the outside of the hull because we were that close into the shore. Early next morning, there was a sudden attack by, I think, about 4 Focke-Wulf, and we had anchored in the later part of the night, and we were just getting the anchor up, and in came these Focke-Wulf and managed to put a bomb into the side of the depot ship called the Bulolo, which was near us, and that caused some panic. And I think that just about summed up D-Day as far as we were concerned. Our role then was to patrol just up and down, up and down, and we did that for, I think, a day or two. And then we came back to Portsmouth then to have our ASDIC dome refitted. Recollections of D-Day, other than that, was of course that at night, as we steamed towards Le Havre and just stoodled around, that you had a ringside seat of the army battling out on the Orne with the Germans on one side, we were on the other, and you could see the tracer going to and fro. But other than that, we were quite spectators in the whole thing. And of course, when we then were taken out of it, because of course we weren't doing any great use there, we were taken back to Portsmouth, as I said, and we went into dock to have our Aztec Dome refitted and replaced. From there, we were then detached along the flanks of the western flanks of the bridgehead, and the idea was then that we should be on the lookout for any E-boats or whatever came into attack. And it was during this that we found ourselves down off the Channel Islands, and as far as I remember, there were about four of us. And I can remember our captain, who was a lieutenant commander this time, putting on a great brave face and saying, "What shall we do, sir? Shall we attack? Da, da, da. Shall we reply fire?" And reply coming back, this was all done by loud hailer, saying, "Well, we'll not be too venturesome, we're just testing the water." And I can remember we were on the near side, and as we approached into Jersey, so the shore batteries on Jersey opened up and fired, and we turned tail quite quickly and got out of it smartly. And it was quite clear that the Germans had no intention of surrendering those on Jersey. Our excursions then were to and fro from Portsmouth. And, well, quite frankly, we were found ourselves in a war. For once, we were on the upper hand, and I must say it felt very pleasant to be in that position. At Portsmouth, we gave weekend leave where we could, and then we moved around to Plymouth. And from Plymouth, our function there was to go down off Brest and down as far as Saint-Nazaire. And the idea was there, of course, to chase up and check on any E-boats and motor gunboats that the Germans had in trying to escape from that little pocket of resistance around Brest, escape down to Spain. And indeed, we did have one quite amusing foray, was that down off the Ile d'Eu, we rounded up a hospital ship called the Rostock, and we came upon the Rostock and ordered her to stop. We sent a boarding party over, and the boarding party went, consisting of one sub-lieutenant, a petty officer, complete with his pistol, and sub-lieutenant with pistol, I think about half a dozen able seamen armed with rifles, and one ERA with a chain and a pistol. And of course the chain is to put into a hatch and prevent it to being closed, the hatch to the engine room. And of course this is a new experience to us, to send off a boarding party. And away went our boarding party, we looked at this lot departing to board the Rostock. They got aboard the Rostock, and the signal was made to Rostock to follow me, and the Rostock followed us dutifully into Plymouth. And I'll never forget arriving in Plymouth very late at night. It must have been about 1 o'clock in the morning, and we heaved to in Corsan Bay, and there was the Rostock under our control. And I'll never forget one in particular able seaman we had aboard, who was quite a fitness man and a muscle man. And this laddie was always saying about, you know, the seamen went away in bare feet even in quite cold weather. And I can remember out of the darkness, and this is something which has always stuck in my mind, though it be about 1 o'clock in the morning, and we're in Corsam Bay, and that's outside the breakwater in Plymouth, and it was quite rough, quite choppy, out of the darkness came a motorboat, not ours, but a motorboat manned by wrens. And these wrens drew up alongside, and they came alongside, and they said, "Here you are, here's your mail." And they heaved up mail, and they were tossing around quite a bit in this, you know. And one or two of the girls were staying, because it was quite rough, from one side of this little moat to the other. And this particular seaman saying to them, "Well, you want to go to sea like us, you see, etc. We have our chappies who do this and do that and the other." And he's shooting quite a lot line to these wrens. And then, out of the darkness, the stillness, you could hear singing. And out of the darkness came our motorboat with our boarding party coming. And our boarding party came alongside, and they'd obviously been at the German schnapps, and they were as drunk as could be. And the sub-lieutenant was rather in disgrace with the captain. And I remember them throwing their rifles up aboard the ship. And here's this seaman of ours who was telling these wrens what real sailors were really like. And these girls must have had the last laugh, because there was the British Navy in action. They was all drunk as lords, throwing their rifles up over the ship. Never forget that. Very funny, that.
This Rostock was a German hospital ship?
Yes. I must go on. Yes. The ERA, his name was the name of Garland, and he was an apprentice with me, and he used to play in the rugby team. And he told me then what had happened on the hospital ship. When they got aboard and boarded the hospital ship, they found that this hospital ship was stuffed full of Nazis, some of them quite high-ranking officers, were bandaged up to their eyebrows, but were quite fit and hale, and they were getting out from Brest. And they were running from Brest to get down to Spain to escape. And the Germans, of course, in the hospital ship, were like our boarding party. The war was over, for them most certainly. They opened up the drinks cabinets, were all wide open, and the Germans were in quite the same frame of mind as ours. Laddies, our boarding party, hence our boarding party became rather tight. They had German nurses aboard there as well, and well, need I say any more about the whole thing? But anyway, the next morning Rostock was taken into inside the breakwater, and that's the last we saw of her. But we ran from Plymouth for several weeks, and it was quite a happy time, in that, as I say, that though we were running and we were at sea and all that sort of thing, the fact is that we were on top now, which was quite a change. We were not on the defensive. And then towards the end of it, we must be now getting into October time, we then left Plymouth and went to Southampton, and we went into dock in Southampton, and we were there, oh, it must have been a month, and we did a little small refit, again something which pleased us. But this refit was a prelude to going out to the Far East. And when this refit was over, we then, and of course, as I say, we came back from leave, and we operated again on the three watch system to get the maximum out of that leave. But then we found ourselves with the Indomitable. There was a carrier, and I can't remember the other destroyer. It might have been the Ulysses, but I wouldn't be too sure on that. But another U-class. But there was this carrier and two of us. We then steamed quite quickly down to Gibraltar, through the Mediterranean, through the Suez, and we arrived eventually out in Trincomalee. And we arrived there, and it would be now getting into the early December, of 1944. The arrival in Trincomalee, rather, we did drop in Colombo on the way around, but that's by the by. But in arriving in Trincomalee, it was rather like going into an eastern Scapa flow. You're going again into a fleet anchorage in which you've got aircraft carriers and battleships and all the sort of cruisers, that sort of thing. And we've just found ourselves tied up with that, oh dear, feeling of alongside a depot ship carrying out a bit of repairs in going back to an anchorage and that sort of thing. Boredom, that's all. And I can remember, it's a beautiful anchorage, that, with jungle on the one side. But I can remember Christmas there quite clearly. And what happened at Christmas was that the cruiser Suffolk had been sent off down to Australia to get turkeys for the fleet. And of course she has limited refrigeration space, and they've got these turkeys and they just hung them around wherever they could in mess decks all over the place in the ship where they thought they would be coolest, and bringing them back. And the idea was to load up the Suffolk, and Suffolk then to go at full speed back to Trincomalee, and so that everyone would have a Christmas dinner of turkey. But unfortunately, no sooner did the Suffolk set sail from Fremantle in Australia with all these turkeys, then she received a signal to say that there was a raider, a German raider, loose in around the Cocos Island, around that coast, the western coast of Australia. And so she was diverted to chase this raider, and this took some time, a few days, with the result that the turkeys gradually got worse and worse and worse, and in the end they all went rotten and they had to be thrown overboard. So when the Suffolk arrived back in Trincomalee without turkeys, great despondency all the way around. And I can remember plainly our Christmas dinner was corned beef and diced carrots. And I can remember then that all the lads who'd stored up their rum, because of course there was no such thing as drink aboard, that rum was the only thing. And the only way of getting over that was to drink a half and store a half, bottle a half. And the result was that on Christmas Day, people were very, very tight. Water polo was attempted between one ship and another, but was not successful. And quite frankly, Christmas Day just turned into a great, no event at all. And I understand that and I know this to be so, the Shore Cinema was a kind of thatched in, you know, with all reeds on it, just because it was open air. And there was a film showing, I was told it was Errol Flynn, Operation Burma, in which Errol Flynn captured Burma all on his own. And the lads were so fed up with this that they burnt the cinema down. Well, they were all drunk again. And the commander-in-chief next day said, well, right, enough of this. And we found ourselves then on early January, and in fact it was on January the 1st, or going off down to the islands of Dutch East Indies to take it out of the Japanese.